Craig, you're a parent, author, and observer. What does education mean today?
I'm also a longtime education journalist, and I've been really doing a deep dive into how education is practiced in all different kinds of communities around the nation. So what it means probably depends on where you live.
Well, based on what you've learned, you know, so what is it? I mean, is it bricks and mortars? Is it, you know, knowing a certain set of things to pass a test? Or, you know, what is it? Being a citizen?
Is that the warm-up question? Is that the question that's supposed to warm me up for
That's the warm-up question, yes, it is.
Because I'm already starting to sweat here.
It's
really hard.
So
what is education? I have come to think that there is an art of explanation that is teaching, and there is the art of most effective explanation that is teaching. And when we start to focus on what we're explaining and how we're explaining it, our schools are going to get a lot better. Right now, I think our schools are embroiled in a lot of debates that are about how schools operate and how the adults in schools get along with each other and are managed. And I think when we start to think about what actually happens in classrooms and what we impart to students, our education, the discussion around education is going to change. Our students are going to learn a lot more.
So you're sort of saying we need to focus more on the content and, let's say, curriculum as opposed to the idea of school, perhaps, eh?
Yeah, I don't even like the word curriculum because it seems like one of those blah blah education terms that everyone gets for themselves, and no one, when you talk to people about curriculum, they mean something different than you're talking about, because everyone kind of, it's like a hockey puck, everyone tries to get it, you know, possession of it, sort of. And so I don't even like to use those school words, those schoolish kind of words like curriculum. Let's talk about what kids are learning. The quality of the teaching, and not quality of teaching like in talk about teacher quality, but in the art of excellent explanation.
So given that, you know, what will change in 5 to 10 years? I mean, or will it change? Will we be having the same conversation a la Groundhog Day in 5 or 10 years, and, you know, just lamenting how it is? What's your sense of that?
I think there could be some dramatic changes in education that could be for the worse in our country. I think that we are running the risk of losing public education or big chunks of public education. And I'm very, very worried about that. I don't see our country making commitments to the civil contract that for the next generation. We have an aging population, and I'm not sure we aren't sort of abandoning the younger generation now. I would like to see a lot more resources and a lot more attention put on education and improving our education.
So is it money or is it attention? I mean, you know, we spend more than anybody else in the world, obviously, and whether it goes in the right place, you know, who knows? But
Well, is money the solution? Absolutely not. I didn't mean to suggest that by my answer. I do think that in terms of our budgeting for our national, you know, our national priorities, healthcare is going to have to become a much bigger priority than education because of the demographics of our population.
Right.
But at the same time, I don't think money is the solution. I see a lot of waste in schools. I also see a lot of people who are lining up to make a profit off of what we spend on a state and federal level on education. I'm very worried about that. As I said, the privatization of public education, I'm deeply concerned about that.
Mm-hmm.
So is money the answer? No. I think really what happens in classrooms is the answer. And I think that we need to focus on that in a global way. I don't mean like all around the world. I mean like from teachers' college to how teachers are trained in teachers' college to what kind of scope and sequence kids get from pre-K to 12th grade to 14th grade, to the end of the associate's degree.
So I agree with that. I'm glad you brought that up. The you know, Wisconsin has had quite a bit of tumult the last year on a number of issues around education and teachers and all. But interestingly, the Medicare spending went up significantly in Wisconsin, my home state. Well, K through 12 is flat after going up, you know, at a regular rate the last few years. So you're right about the priorities and all that. I definitely get that. So given your experience, and if you were king or queen for the next few years, let's say, what would be the one or two things you think that would pull that off? I mean, what's the lever you can use to address these things effectively?
I have hopes for the Common Core. I'm watching intently the development of the Common Core assessment, which I know sounds unbelievably wonky, but and it's not something I bring up like in cocktail party conversation because I would just be standing by myself within seconds. But the Common Core to me is a great hope because it's finally talking about what happens in the classroom. But like everything in education, what gets tested gets taught, and the way those assessments are rolled out and the way and their effectiveness will determine whether the Common Core meets the goals that we have for it, or we hope for it, or fails. So I'm obsessed with that, and you know, when I talk to education people, I have to be very careful not to get carried away, because I really think that we're at a moment where there could be something wonderful happening, but the assessment process, the development of the assessments, really worries me. It doesn't seem to be going that well.
So you're an astute observer of these things. I've only been, you know, reasonably involved in education for 9 years and have seen any number of these initiatives where, right, there's a lot of promise, and then you look at the details and it's rather thin. So I appreciate your perspective. So what prompted this this interest in education? What was the spark that moved you from observer to activist, journalist, all of that in education?
Yeah, I'm not an activist, I will tell you.
Oh, come on.
I'm not. I'll tell you briefly my life story. I was born, no, seriously, I started my career as a journalist covering crime.
Right.
And you cover crime for a long time, and you realize that it's very banal, and you start to realize that one person killed another person in a horrendous way, but if you look at their lives, it looks like it was like two trains on a track heading for each other. Like the miracle would have been if they didn't end up killing each other. And it became a kind of inevitability to the conflicts that I saw. And so I asked myself, sort of my intellectual journey of like, why is this happening? Why are these trains set on a collision course? And what I came to was lack of opportunity, and you dig deeper into that, and it's lack of education.
Right.
And so I actually come at education, most journalists come at education because they have kids, or they think that kids are cute, or their parents were teachers, and they have warm feelings about school, and I have really mixed feelings about school, and yes, kids are cute, but I actually come at this from a sort of like social... Mm. It's sort of like a harder-nosed perspective.
Yeah.
And also, I hate education, blah, blah. I hate people using school words and pretending that they're having a dialogue when they're really just jargoning at each other. I hate people telling me they have the answer to poverty, that they have the answer to the achievement gap, when you know, and I know, every intelligent person who's listening to this knows that it's more complicated than that. So I'm not exactly a misanthropic, but I'm just like a pretty, I'm an investigative reporter by trade, so I'm just kind of like a show me kind of gal. I'm just like, yeah, really? Very interesting froth. Show me.
You know, periodically I receive emails from parents inquiring about school evaluation. So given your experience, what do you recommend for parents? How do you look at this and make any kind of informed decision?
About schools?
Yeah, you know, so I'm going to move here. Where should I
move?
So
I wrote this book. I got a fellowship from the Spencer Foundation and spent a year at Columbia thinking my big thoughts. And I felt so guilty about taking money for nothing that I wrote this book for parents that basically condenses 25 years of education research into a pretty readable, I have to say, sometimes funny read for parents, very approachable, not jargony at all. And it goes through, the book is called Good School, and the paperback came out in September. And it basically breaks down, first by preschool, then what test scores mean, then what class size, what we know about class size and its impact on academic achievement, then what a good reading program looks like, then what a good math program looks like, and then a little bit about teacher quality. So I don't have a blueprint for a perfect school, but I can make parents more informed. I've tried in this book to try and make parents more informed about the decisions they're making for their kids.
So, you know, of those things you mentioned, you know, what would be the, if again, when I get these emails, what would be the top two or three things, you know, parents should look for when they're considering schools?
I would say to look for, to take test scores as an indicator, but not as a positive test, you know, high test scores as a positive indicator, but not as a lock of what a good school is, and not to take 1 year's test scores very seriously, because really it's test scores over time. And test scores on standardized tests are an information point, a data point, and they suggest other questions that you need to ask, and they can unearth some information about a school, but they're just one data point. So that's one of the first things. And the second thing I would say is that you should look at, if it's elementary school, you should look at their reading program. And if it's not basically, if it's not, in my view, like saturated with phonics.
Right, phonics and grammar, yep.
You should then look at what their remediation rate is, like how many kids go to the reading specialist by fifth grade. And if it's more than four, okay, don't put your kid in that class. That's cool.
Yeah, I appreciate that one. I agree with that wholeheartedly. Wow.
Because I don't feel like I have any, like, I'm not in the sort of politics of curriculum. I actually have spent time with neuroscientists who know how the human brain reads.
Right.
And when you talk about what they know to teachers, they act like you're a heretic. You know, they act like you're freaking Martin Luther. Like, it's just like, you know, really, you need to read the science. It's not that obscure. It's not that hard to understand. And I'm shocked and dismayed by the fact that teachers think that how they do it is a personal choice and a sort of art form. Oh, listen, it is an art form. I mean, all teaching is kind of, you know, I think it's very elevated, but there is a best way. That seems to be a very political notion.
Yeah, it's ironic. I agree with you. I think that is problem and job number one for our education money is reading. I mean, it's just very, very sad to me that we're in the situation we're in today.
But what I learned, you know, what I learned in, like, really reporting the heck out of reading and what makes a good reading program is that literacy isn't just reading. Literacy is also speaking and not just decoding, but comprehension. And in order to get those skills fully online, you need to have writing right in there. It's a kind of a three-thread rope: speaking, reading, and writing. And we define literacy now as decoding, which is incredibly thread. It's just a thread there, and in sort of mindless approach. It's just feeble. I don't know if it's mindless. It's just feeble. It's a feeble approach to education.
Well, I appreciate your perspective on that. I'm going to switch to a little different topic now. So we're going to travel in my time machine back to when you were 18, Peg. And so what would you do? You know, what would you study if you were 18 going off to college? What would you study, knowing what you do now?
You know what I'm fascinated with now that I would never have thought about is math.
Math.
I'm like ready for mass now. I'm 52.
52,
I'm,
ready for mass.
I'm ready for mass.
Bring it on.
I was just thinking this the other day. I'm so ready for mass. I have this book about mathematicians, like super high-end mathematicians. It's their like biographies, and I've been and how they approach what they know. And I'm not even clear what it is they're talking about most of the time. It's like, you know, guys from MIT talking about sort of inside baseball stuff. But I'm fascinated by math cognition. And I would never say this in front of my children, I totally missed the boat. Like, I just missed the math boat. And it's my laziness or instructional malpractice. I'm not ready to assign blame. It was probably mostly me. But I'm ready for math now. And if I could be 18 again, I would say, get help. I got help in algebra, but like, get help in trigonometry, and don't be such a wimp. Like, you can do this, you know. And I would have loved. I didn't understand what it was. I didn't understand that math is an extraordinary tool and a beautiful, beautiful language.
Interesting. Good.
Yeah, I'm like a word girl, you know. Like, I'm, you know, this, as you know from my Atlantic piece, I'm like all about reading and writing, but.
Right. Grammar girl,
don't say grammar girl. That makes me sound so boring. Okay.
Well, you're hardly boring, Big.
So, can we say that grammar is just like the buzzkill term of all time? Like, don't you say grammar and get a little sweaty? Like, you know, someone's going to say like subjunctive clause after that, and you're not sure what it means.
Yeah, but I'm thankful for all that stuff I had all those years ago. It's, you know, what a difference. So, looking back on all that, your books, your journalism experience, your parenting, all of that, there have been wins and losses like all of us. You know, what are you most proud of?
I'm really proud of this Atlantic story that's running now.
Yep.
That story is 4 years of work for me, four
wow.
years of research, and 4 years of deep dive, actually even more than that, I know about 4 years of deep dive research. Previous to The Good School, I wrote a book about boys and education.
Yes.
And I wrote a book about, and basically I'm a grateful beneficiary of the feminist movement, not afraid to say it, and I also have brothers and a husband and sons. And so I wrote that book because I wanted to make it okay for women to say, like, hey, what is going on academically with our sons? You know, and not to be part of a backlash dialogue.
Right.
And so I wrote it in a very progressive, like, okay, let's just talk about this for what it is. Let's just talk about equity, gender equity, for what it really looks like now. So that began my focus, because I think where boys really struggle in school is around reading and writing, and that's in the data. And I started to ask myself, of course, why do they really struggle in reading and writing? What happens in classrooms? And I do believe it has to do with the instruction. There is some cognitive predisposition to be better in spatial relations and for girls to be more verbal in the main, in general. But there's things that happen in the classroom that exacerbate those seemingly natural differences. So I really started working on this like in 2007. And really, I've been just grinding away at the research, trying to make myself smarter and smarter about what is literacy, what is writing, what is speaking, how it works from brain science right to classroom practice. And so this story in 2012, in October of 2012, is really like a culmination of a tremendous amount of work. Every line, every thought in that story represents months of every line represents months of work for me, so I'm very proud of it, actually.
And you should be. I found it to be a breath of fresh air. I appreciate the fact that you did it and they published it, and I'm sure they paid you for all that time very well.
That worked out to be about a half a cent an hour.
Right. I was gonna wondering if it was a penny or not.
You know, I was astonished that they spent, I mean, that was a really complex story. It was a story about how writing extends thinking. It's a very complex idea and a very abstract idea, and I was delighted that The Atlantic gave it the space that it did.
Yeah, I agree. So, thinking a bit different now at school models, you know, you obviously spent lots of time thinking about these things. You've, as I said, written books and articles. Do you have any views on traditional, you know, the factory model we have now, the Frederick Taylor factory model, charters, vouchers, private, virtual, you know, what, and any pros and cons of them, or is it just, as you say, all come down to the teacher, the classroom, and that's it?
I wish that I could say, like, if you can get your kids into private school, they'll be fine, or just send them to a charter school and they'll be great. What I see is that schools are very variable, and that there's no kind of school that's particularly better than others. The devil is always in the details with education. That said, I will say I'm warming to those core knowledge schools because I'm seeing really good data come out of them. Core knowledge being the Edie Hirsch, schools, which are very focused on delivering a certain kind of content. Now, I diverge with Edie Hirsch because he is very invested in the Western canon, and as I used to think about it, as those dead white guys. But I actually think that a content-rich curriculum is where it is always going to make a better school. What I've learned is that teachers spend a lot of time learning about this kind of idiotic process of education and not really about the things they're teaching. So I've actually been in classrooms where teachers, in second grade, teachers are talking about text-to-reader relationship to second graders. And I'm like, are you on crack? Does that make any sense to you? So I've like become sort of aversive to the dominance of process and started to value and see more of the value of championing content. I'm not sure that Edie Hirsch, I mean, all respect to Edie Hirsch, he's way smarter than I am, but I'm not sure that by canonizing the white dead men, he hasn't, I mean, we are a very brown country now, we're getting browner, and I think that's A-okay. And I think we have to we also have to recognize that, like, what we thought of as the great writers 100 years ago may need to also be adjusted to keep pace with the times in our global world.
Yeah, agreed. I agree. So what about higher ed? You know, there's people who talk about reckoning. There's a guy who's a top scientist here in Madison at the University of Wisconsin who thinks, you know, 5 years from now, the online guys, the Courseras and all these, will have a material effect on the higher ed game. You know, what's your view of that?
It's a bubble. It's a bubble. And I'm paying those bills right now, and I'm about to start paying them for number two.
Yeah.
And let me say, it's my privilege to pay them, okay? But I am well aware that I'm participating. I might as well be buying tulips in Holland in like 300 or 250 years ago. It's a joke. There's nothing that they could be delivering, that short of a medical degree at the end of those 4 years, that could possibly pay off in the way that they're acting. I mean, it's ridiculous. It's ridiculous, and it can't last. And I don't think it's going to be a hard landing. I think it's going to be a soft landing for colleges, at least elite colleges. I have deep concern about the way that low-income children are being pushed out of higher education. I'm encouraged by the pathways that Latino strivers and low-income black student strivers are getting to college. They're getting to community college, and in certain regions, they're doing very well in community college, and that they're starting, because their numbers are so great in community college, they're starting to force articulation between 2-year community colleges and 4-year state schools. Because right now, you can go to community college, but the local state school won't let you in because they prefer to have a freshman. What is that?
Money.
What is that? Yeah, but come on, those kids are killing themselves. Yeah. You know, they have kids, they drop off their kids in daycare, they are working part-time, and they're getting an associate's degree. I love those kids, okay? Those kids have my heart. Those are the strivers. Those are the people who make America great, who made America great 30 years ago, and will make America great again. And what do? We slap those people down.
Yeah.
And I'm deeply concerned about that.
Last question. you have obviously dabbled in different varieties of communication, you know, classic books, articles in magazines, and obviously the newspapers, blogging, Twittering. You know, what's effective? I mean, are they all sort of effective in different degrees, or what? You know, what do you think?
Well, I'm just having the best time tweeting now, I have to tell you. it's like being a bumper sticker writer. And I used to teach at the Columbia Graduate School of Journalism, so all my students are like reaching me on Twitter, and they're like, "Teddy, what are you doing on Twitter?" And I'm tweeting back like, "Evolve or die, baby."
You're old. yeah, I know. What are you doing?
I'm trying. You know, I actually really, I'm sort of in a Twitter moment, but I lecture a lot. I write books. I write long form magazine stories. I bore people at cocktail parties. I don't really know what the most effective is. Whenever a door opens, I walk through it, mm-hmm. of communicating about the issues I think are important. No one's asked me to be Secretary of Education or anything, so I'm not exactly like in a position of huge influence. But
when you think about this Common Core, you know, the assessments and the both the opportunity and the risk with that, you know, and let's say you have something that you want to say that is important that you've researched, you know, you've spent 4 years, and you know, is it the article in the Atlantic? Is it, you know, constantly tweeting about it? Is it, you know, going on the old TV shows or, you know, or influencing newspapers? I mean, what would you do?
Well, I've published pieces in the Times. You know, you kind of have to hit the zeitgeist at the right moment. Like, yeah. You kind of have to think about your messaging. How, and sometimes you hit it and sometimes you don't. I mean, my boys book was a New York Times bestseller and, you know, really was a huge phenomenon in its way. The Good School, I think, is a lot more useful. Did not have the same, like, media frenzy around it. So it's hard to know, you know, it's hard to know. Listen, I don't think Twitter itself is very effective unless you have a deep well of information and that you're kind of teasing onto Twitter. But I'm ready to try everything. I mean, I was a television correspondent for a couple of years, and I'm very interested in doing a documentary about what I saw at Newdorf. Because I think that you can make this very abstract idea of writing and thinking, there's a way that you could make it very visual. And I'd like to tackle that. I was actually talking to the people who were, I shouldn't say what they do, but if they do a reality TV show, and they're interested in maybe doing it, but as their serious project, I don't think it's going to go forward. But I'd love, you know, to connect with a documentary filmmaker to try and do the Atlantic article as a documentary.
So what that tells me is you think that either a short or a long-form documentary would be more effective in reaching more people than the Atlantic article. Is that true?
I don't know about more people. Uh-huh. I don't know. I have 16,000 Facebook likes for a story whose dramatic tension hangs on the subordinating clause. I mean, what's the possibility of that, right? Yeah. It's extraordinary. So clearly I've charted some sort of swing back in the pendulum. Mm-hmm. You know, like, clearly I've like nailed some moment now where people are starting to like grow weary of what we have. Mm-hmm. Otherwise the story would have just sat there, because it's a very deep story, it's a very detailed story. I mean, I think it's a great job, but like I've done a lot of great jobs and people have not responded in the
right,
same way.
Right. And a sort of a subset of that, and what I was getting at is, so as you've observed the education system, again, as a parent, journalist, and a book author and things, you know, have you observed anybody who's been more effective at communicating with parents, students, teachers, and taxpayers? And, you know, can you glean anything from that?
Yeah, I don't really think people do a very good... I don't think, in general, parents are very, very well informed.
Mm-hmm.
I know I wasn't. And, yeah. I'm an education reporter.
Right.
So,
right.
I think that parents are really in the dark, and I think that they're a little bit in an echo chamber of people who think the same way they do, and they say the same things to each other back and forth until they believe it even more.
yes.
And some of it's just nonsense. So I think that school systems in general do a terrible job of communicating with parents, but in fairness, schools shouldn't have to educate your kids and educate the parents also. Like, right. Parents need to get up to speed a little bit. I don't see anyone doing a wonderful job at that. I don't. That's why I wrote the book. I thought it would be a good contribution to the discourse.
Yeah, interesting. Well, I appreciate your time, Peg. I'm going to stop recording here. And
okay.
Yeah, so...